This is Tea Earl Grey Heart, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. The Forge. Hello and welcome to Tea Earl Grey Hot, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. My name is Dave and I am joined this week, as every week really, by my good friend Yannick. Yannick, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Good evening, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing all right, actually. I've kind of got over the excitement of getting to the end of the Augments arc from last week with Jason, and of course, we really must say thank you to Jason very much for joining us last week. From a personal perspective, it was both a joy to have him on the show and also an absolute pain in the backside because the editing for last week's show was, for want of a better phrase, interesting.
My fault, actually.
Well, no, to be fair, you did me a favour because what started off as 2 hours and 15 minutes of recording actually pared down quite nicely to just over an hour and 40. So, no, I'm happy with that. That's not too bad. But, no, it was good to have him on last week. It was good to have his insight. Now, what we should probably do is apologise to him. We didn't get much of a chance to talk to him about him and his background in Star Trek. So I think we probably will be inviting him back at some point
we're going to have to.
In the future. Definitely. So on this week's show, then, we are going to be reviewing episode 7 of season 4 of Star Trek Enterprise, entitled The Forge. Now, as I understand it, this is not just the start of a new three-part story arc, it's also the continuation of another story arc that's been going on for quite some time, which is relating to the Andorians. So it's I think by the time we do episode 9, so 2 weeks after this one, we're going to have the end of two story arcs. So it'd be nice to see these two things converge. So are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Okay, let's review episode 7 of season 4 of Star Trek Enterprise, The Forge. So, in the teaser for this episode, we are about 17 years in the past on the planet Vulcan. 2137 is the year we're in, and we're seeing a young Vulcan male wandering alone through a subterranean tunnel on the planet Vulcan. He finds a sculptured casing that is completely covered in dust. Using a brush, the young man wipes away the dust from the casing to reveal a symbol, and he utters a single word, Surak.
Yeah. Did you notice that this casing, which is probably made of stone, looked very light in his hand? It was
It looked like it could have potentially been made of cardboard. Yeah. Yeah. I was intrigued by it because this is, we'll probably be covering this a bit later on, but it's one of a number of trinkets within the Vulcan, I don't know what you'd call it, called IDEX. And if you look at the different things that crop up, we're going to see one more of the things later on in this episode, but apparently throughout a lot of the Star Trek universe, these IDEX come up multiple times. And this thing, I don't know. It looked like it was missing a clock face, and it would have gone on my mantelpiece.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, that was the credits roll moment. The word Surak. So, at the beginning of Act 1, we are actually hearing, for a change, Admiral Forrest recording a personal log. He says, "I've arrived on Vulcan hopeful that the High Command is finally ready to conduct joint missions with Starfleet." So we're back up to current time, and Admiral Forrest has travelled to Vulcan to learn of the Vulcan High Command's decision on whether to start conducting joint missions with Starfleet. At the embassy, Forrest is discussing the matter with Ambassador Soval, and is surprised to learn that Soval was not consulted by the Council. He's not been included in any of their conversations. Regarding the Vulcan reluctance to share technologies, Soval explains that humans are confusing to them, and that the fast progress of human development in recent years is greatly concerning the Vulcans. Now, in that scene, Forrest suggested that Vulcans are afraid of humans, and Soval said something which I found incredibly poignant. He said that it's because there is one species that humans remind them of. And Forrest works out what he's saying.
Yeah.
He's talking about Vulcans.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, the Vulcans have had their wars like the humans have, obviously, but whereas Vulcans took over 1,500 years to rebuild their civilizations and get themselves back into space, humans took less than 100. And I think that worried, well, I say worried Soval, I think that has worried the Vulcans, that maybe they're slower or have been slower to evolve. And I don't get this, because Vulcans, certainly from my perspective, Vulcans have always considered themselves a more superior race, certainly a more superior intellect to humans. So I'm not quite sure why, in this particular instance, Soval, presumably representing Vulcans as a whole, is scared.
Well, maybe they are scared of humans, you know, going too fast, actually. As in, it took 1,500 years for the Vulcans to develop space travel and you know, embrace logic and everything. And they see humans, you know, going straight at it, like as if they didn't have time to reflect on what happens. And where Vulcans probably will not carry war and troubles on other planets, they might be afraid that humans will. You know, that they didn't learn anything, they didn't have time to reflect on that, and they will bring their problems and conflicts to space. That's how I took it.
Yeah, I'll accept that. Suddenly, an explosion is heard by the two men, and Forrest quickly pushes Soval to the ground as the embassy is engulfed in flames. On the Enterprise, the senior officers are enjoying a spirited game of basketball in Launch Bay 2. Phlox, who is exceptionally good and has to keep switching teams, likens the games to Octron fertility contests, but, as he says, with more clothing. T'Pol then summons Archer away from the game to give him the bad news.
Yeah.
Now, I know that they're on a spaceship and they have to find ways to entertain themselves, but I couldn't help relating them playing basketball in Launch Bay 2 to the kind of thing that I used to get up to when I was much, much earlier in my career. I'm talking like 20-something years ago. Playing football in our computer room at the office, and in fact we kind of swapped between playing football and playing frisbee. The frisbee had to be stopped after I knocked one of the smoke detectors off the wall and nearly set off the halon. But that aside, it certainly seemed to me as though they were potentially playing a sports game in an area where maybe they shouldn't have done. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as you said, they have to get you know, exercise and entertain. So, yeah, I guess Launch Bay is as good as any other place.
The space is there.
Yeah, what I notice is that Phlox doesn't actually move. He just stays there, and then somebody pass the ball, and then he just, you know, shoots a basket. How do you call that?
Yeah. He's like the 7-foot one in the team, where you don't have to you don't have to run around, you don't have to dribble the ball, you just shoot it and it goes in every single time. I would have really liked to have seen him slam dunk it and then hang off the hang off the basket.
It's not his style, I think.
No, I'd imagine not. No, definitely. So, in the next scene, we are listening to Captain Archer recording a log. And he says, Enterprise has arrived at Vulcan as ordered. 3 days after the bombing of Earth's embassy, the death toll stands at 43, and I have lost my friend, Admiral Forrest. Vulcan authorities still have no lead on who's responsible. Now, from the explosion we saw on the on Vulcan in the Earth embassy, there was no indication, no clue that we received as viewers that Forrest would have been killed in that explosion.
Yeah, that's true. I actually was surprised by Archer's log.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know. Forrest has always been one of those constants throughout the entirety of Star Trek Enterprise. And I don't know if he... We're on episode 7. There are 22 episodes in the series. I thought if they were going to take him out, it would have been like later on in the series, not so early.
Yeah, as we said, I think it was maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, he was the link between the humans and the Vulcans. He always was on the borderline between both parties. So now with Forrest gone, we're going to see what's going to happen in the future episodes, but...
Hold that thought, because something related to that comes up later on in this episode.
So why did they kill him now? I don't know. It didn't seem logical at this point, if I can, no pun intended, but that he was killed on Vulcan. But we'll see what the writers have in store for us for the future episodes.
Yes, indeed. Archer is met by Administrator Vlas at Enterprise's airlock. Vlas is the head of the Vulcan High Command. He's joined by Ambassador Saval and Stell, who is the chief investigator of the Security Directorate. After Archer rejects the suggestion that the bomb was planted by Andorians, Stell reluctantly reveals that Cyrenites are also under suspicion. Now, Archer mistakes this, to be fair, as do I, as the name of another species, but T'Pol corrects him, explaining that they are a small group of Vulcans who follow a corrupted form... Look at this, I'm doing air quotes. A corrupted form of Cyrax's teachings. The Cyrenites' logical and peaceful nature make them very unlikely candidates. When Archer asks if there's any evidence pointing towards the Cyrenites, Saval points out that the embassy is officially considered to be on Earth soil, therefore placing any investigation of the crime scene under Starfleet's jurisdiction. I did look into the Cyrenites, and I don't think up to this point we've actually met them. We don't actually know who they are. One of the people who is sympathetic to the Cyrenites, who we will have met, as this particular character did appear in the original series. But to be fair, it was so far in the past, I certainly wouldn't have remembered it from then.
No, me neither.
Archer then sends Reed and Mayweather down to investigate the blast site, where Mayweather uncovers... I'm calling them by their surnames now. What am I doing? Uncovers an undetonated bomb. Reed, Malcolm, scans the device and discovers that there is Vulcan DNA on the controls. A closer scan triggers the device, but the two officers manage to transport back to the Enterprise only seconds before it explodes. So there was a little bit of a squeaky moment when Malcolm said he got the Enterprise on standby and said, "Prepare to transport on my mark." And then he gave his mark, and then nothing happened. And then he's like, "Enterprise!" And they got beamed out just as... in fact, it was a chain reaction, wasn't it? Because Travis was holding some wall or something up that had originally been covering the bomb over. So obviously, once they get transported out, he's not going to be holding that up anymore. It's going to land on it and boom, which is exactly what happened.
Yeah.
I think my quote of the episode came from this scene. And it's when Malcolm said, look on the bright side. If it does detonate, we'll never know.
Yeah. I think it could have been said by Trip. It would have been as effective. It's one of those quotes that, you know, it just works.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
I have a remark or a question here. As with every time someone is transported while holding something, at what point does that thing, you know, falls? Because they're essentially dematerializing the person, so it's supposed to fall through the person as soon as it starts being dematerialized. And as in this instance, the panel fell after Mayweather was completely transported. So
yes,
but I understand the technical difficulties for the movie making, but it's still strange that you could hold something up until your last atom is still there and then it fails. You know.
But that then raises another question, because Malcolm was holding, well, he shoved the communicator under his shoulder. Yeah. while he was scanning, but then the scanner and the communicator, they got beamed out.
Yes.
With them. So I don't know, maybe they were tagged in some way.
Probably,
the lock, because it can't be a force field, because otherwise he would have ended up taking some of this panel with him.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a good good observation there.
You could argue that they are always transported with their clothes on, so there's something there too.
Yeah, that might be something for a later conversation. So back on the Enterprise, Phlox's investigation matches the recovered DNA to a character called T'Pau, who is a well-known Cyrenite. Now, T'Pau was the character I mentioned before who did appear on, I think it was an episode in season one of the original series. The captain asks if she has a criminal record or previous criminal record, but T'Pau explains that the DNA of every Vulcan is recorded at birth. When Archer attempts to pursue the leads further, Stell says that since T'Pau is a Vulcan, the overall investigation consequently now falls under Vulcan jurisdiction and that Starfleet assistance is not required. He said he will have Saval inform them of anything they need to know, much to Archer's disappointment.
Typical Vulcan.
Yeah, this seemed... It was at this point I thought, what is going on? Because the placement of the investigation onto Starfleet was unconditional. So it's your crime. It happened on Earth soil, because the embassy is considered Earth soil. It's your investigation. Then all of a sudden, because a Vulcan is implicated, they've yanked back the entire investigation.
Yeah.
Back to Vulcan. That sounded wrong to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. 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 There was something fishy there.
I don't know whether you're aware, actually, that there was a British band in the 1980s called T'Pau.
Really? No.
Yeah.
I didn't.
look them up. I mean, they typically 80s, very much so. But apparently, their band name came from that character. Yeah. So I'm wondering if we can get Carol Decker, who's the lead singer of T'Pau, to actually guest on the show with us.
But if you don't ask, we won't know.
Well, we've got this far by asking.
Yeah.
I might actually reach out to her on Twitter and see if I even get a response.
Yeah. That would be great.
So the next scene is quite a moving one, actually. Archer enters the cargo bay on the Enterprise, where the bodies of the 31, I think it was, humans that were lost in the bombing are being held for transport back to Earth. While quietly reflecting over the coffin of Admiral Forrest, the captain is joined by Ambassador Saval, who notes that the Admiral died saving his life when he could have saved his own instead. Now, I did pick up on the fact that the moment that Saval went into the cargo bay and announced his presence to Archer, Archer was very quick to try and dismiss him.
Yeah, with a very sarcastic response, as in said, if you're lost, I can show you to your shuttle.
Precisely. But the whole thing of Forrest saving Saval, I think has confused Saval quite strongly. And I notice that in this scene, he's actually frowning quite a bit. And I'm wondering whether he's actually able to understand what Forrest actually did. Because what you're talking about here is a sacrifice.
Yeah.
By pushing Saval to the ground and effectively shielding him from the bomb, he has sacrificed himself in order to save Saval. And of course, the Vulcan mantra is the needs of the many. So this goes completely against.
Yeah. I wonder if Saval was maybe about to cry at some point in the when he was talking to Archer.
It did look he was very somber. There was definitely an internal emotional battle going on there. No question at all. But Saval and Archer also appeared to be hinting at the start of something here. Now, Saval's involvement with the Vulcans had always been, you know, down the middle, trying not to take sides in either way. He was obviously trying to be an arbitrator, you know, somebody who tries to hold things together, a facilitator, if you like, of talks. But during the conversation with Saval before the bomb went off, Forrest did mention about humans and Vulcans trying to work closer together in joint missions. And Archer responds to that by saying, we have to make that possible.
Yes.
And he says, despite the high command. But I'm wondering if... I know where this is going. I know what happens in the last episode of the overall series. I know what it leads into. But is this the first real hint we're getting of the potential of a formation of a planetary federation?
It is, yes. It is the first time we see Saval and Archer actually working together. I mean, we saw at the beginning of this season when Saval said, "Okay, I would," you know, he was blaming Archer for the crew, the Vulcan crew that died on season 3, yeah. And then he ended up saying, "Okay, I would have done the same thing." And then, you know, they shake hands. But in this episode, they are actually working together. They're doing things. Saval is helping Archer for real, and I believe that's the first time he does that. Previously was, you know, trying to maybe help if he could, but not getting really involved. But it's a change in this episode. It's a change in Saval's way of dealing with Archer and the humans.
Yeah, I mean, what you mentioned just then about what happened, I think it was episode 3, Home, when that exchange happened and there seemed to be like an understanding and maybe even a level of respect between Saval and Archer. That this is, to be fair, every time we've seen them since then, they've almost been, they've spoken as equals,
yeah,
rather than Saval taking the superior ground.
Yeah, as colleagues or as a, you know, yeah.
That's a good word, yeah.
Working on the same team.
Exactly. So Saval makes clear that there is no reason or evidence to suggest that the Cyranites are responsible for the bombing, and he doesn't understand why they are being accused. He urges Archer not to leave the investigation in the hands of the Vulcan High Command, but to question everything and go down to Vulcan whilst also promising the captain his full support. So this just it's just an extension of what we just spoke about. What we've got here actually is we've got trust.
Yes.
So Saval is trusting Archer more than he's trusting his own government.
That's what I was going to say. He's trusting him to the point that is, I'm not going to say he's ready to betray the High Council, but he's ready to go against them to help Archer.
In the next scene, Koss visits T'Pol in her quarters. Now, T'Pol is not particularly pleased to see her husband, but he insists that a face-to-face meeting was necessary. He gives T'Pol an edict that T'Less, her mother, wanted passed along, claiming that it was a family heirloom. Koss explains that the new security conditions on Vulcan following the bombing has forced T'Less into hiding because she is actually a Cyrenite.
Yeah, that felt like a bomb. I mean, I was not expecting that.
No, but also, I'm still not... I mean, obviously, I've done the research since then, but and we find out later on in the episode, but I still wasn't sure at this point exactly what that meant. What did it mean to be a Cyrenite? But clearly, whatever it is, it's bad enough that those people that are Cyrenites or follow the teachings of Cyren have determined that it's necessary for them to go into hiding. But this eidic is come up before in other Star Treks, but it's a Vulcan. I want to use the word trinket, but I don't want to make it sound trivial. IDIC stands for Infinite Diversity in Infinite Combinations. Now, it does have a Vulcan name, which I haven't written down, so I can't tell you what it is. But IDIC is how it's identified within how it's known within English. And apparently, the items that are IDICs, they symbolise the elements that create that create truth and beauty. That is how they're defined. But we'll see more about that later on.
The greetings between husband and wife is really cold.
I would say cringeworthy, yeah. But cold's a good word as well.
Just you know what they do this thing with the hands. They're really. Far away from each other when they greet, and again we have the greeting that T'Pol's mother gave her when she came to Vulcan first. It's agreeable to see you.
Yeah, and, yeah. No, I spotted that one as well.
Yeah,
but it was really odd. Koss was trying to be touchy feely with her. He put his hand across her face at one point, which she, you know. She backed off from. Yeah. But I don't know whether you picked up on this, but it seemed to me that when the bell went at the door, T'Pol knew who it was before she even opened the door.
Well, he probably asked to be transported on the Enterprise, and then the Enterprise probably, told people T'Pol that he was coming to see her. I mean. Doesn't surprise me too much.
I suppose so. Yeah. I suppose, yes.
You know, you don't just transport in a spaceship and then wander around and go see whoever you want to see. I mean, there was a guard with him.
There was a guard, yes. There was a guard outside the door.
So probably they asked T'Pol if she wanted to see him.
Oh, well, that would explain it then. If she actually knew he was there, then yeah, that would explain the anxiety she showed.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. She looked very anxious for no apparent reasons. Before we saw a Koss at the door, but I was well, why is she like that? She looked very tense, and yeah.
So she knew, but we didn't.
Yeah,
which I think is not right. We should know as well. All right, so we now move into Act 2 of the episode. T'Pol, having never seen this heirloom that's been presented to her by Koss, she takes it to Archer, explaining what it is and that it's been modified. And she activates the... I don't know what you call it. It's an amulet, isn't it? She activates the amulet, and in typical, I can't explain what typical it is, because we see it all the time, where you've got this little dot on the table, and suddenly it projects a 3D image in the air in front of you. It's kind of like a hologram, maybe, but it displays a topographical map of the forge, which is an area on Vulcan. Now, it occurred to me that this map is clearly showing where T'Less, T'Pau, and the others may actually be in hiding. And I think this is really quite an intelligent thing for T'Less to do, because it was used as a way for T'Less to tell T'Pol where she was, but without actually letting Kos know.
Yes, but Kos knows that T'Less is in hiding. He knows that she's a Saronite. So I would suppose that he is a Saronite too. I mean, why would T'Less give him the IDIC for him to give to T'Pol? And how would he know that she's a Saronite too, and that she's in hiding and all that?
But if I don't think it's unreasonable for him to know that she's a Saronite. You can pick it up if you're around people for long enough that they may have political or social leanings towards a particular ethos.
Yes, I guess.
But I think if Kos was a Saronite, why wasn't he in hiding as well?
Yeah. Okay.
And it's a difficult one. It your question's valid, and actually, no, it doesn't make sense. If Kos wasn't a Saronite, and I'm thinking that he isn't, and he obviously didn't understand the significance of the IDIC that T'Less asked him to send to T'Pol, of course, why wouldn't a husband go and visit his wife?
Yeah, that's okay.
You know, there's nothing necessarily suspicious about that. But I'm curious to know how T'Pol realized that the amulet had been modified.
Yeah, that's
but
a good point.
Not knowing.
That's a good point, yes.
Maybe, I don't know.
No, I'm not going to make any friends here, but I was kind of expecting to see Princess Leia coming out of this device. You know, when she pressed the thing, and I was wondering, it looks like one of those holograms they have on the Star Wars.
Right.
No comments. Send your hate mail directly to me.
Listeners, we are now on the lookout for a new co-host.
Listeners, I'm going to start a new podcast pretty soon.
Feel the Force or something, I don't know. Anyway, back to the Star Trek universe, because that's what we're talking about here, Yannick. Against Tucker's warnings that the Forge is a hellhole with electrical sandstorms and geomagnetic instabilities, which will prevent the use of any technology, Archer decides to transport down to Vulcan with T'Pol in search of the Saronites. Saval provides data on the gaps in Vulcan satellite surveillance, so that Archer and T'Pol's beam-in won't be monitored, but he remains aboard to assist Tucker with the investigation from orbit.
Yeah, there was a nice quote from Trip in this scene that we can't transport it. You're going to have to walk there. What? Walking? Nobody walks anymore.
I thought Saval was brilliant in this scene. We spoke before about how Vulcans are able to lie and deceive without lie and deceiving.
Yeah.
But when he gave this data module to to Archer to find out the locations where they could beam down to. In fact, I think he gave it to Trip, not to Archer.
Oh, yeah.
It's identified that actually what he's done is illegal. But Saval just says, I don't know what you're talking about. All I've done is given you a data module.
Absolutely, yes. What did Spock say?
An error.
An error, not a lie.
An error. So Archer and T'Pol are now beamed down to Gateway. This is an area of the Forge that where it was the location where Sirak supposedly began his journey into the Forge. Archer then questions T'Pol about her apparent lack of belief in some of the stories of Sirak. She answers by telling him that Sirak's writings from that period were lost, and the current copies of his teaching are open to interpretation, a fact that Archer finds rather amusing and familiar.
Yeah, I beg the love, yeah.
Yes. It doesn't surprise me that some of the teachings from Sirak have, they've effectively gone through a whole series of Chinese whispers, haven't they? And people have written down what they think they interpret from, yeah, from something, and yeah, the whole thing gets distorted. Later that night, their conversation is interrupted by the screech of a sellout.
Yeah.
Now, I looked into this. I'd never heard of a sellout before. And it's described as like a teddy bear creature.
It didn't look like a teddy bear.
It didn't look like a teddy bear at all. But apparently, they can't climb.
Yes.
So all they had to do was get to higher ground before the creature could get to them. And T'Pol tells Archer that these things are available in domesticated models. Vulcan children keep these things as pets. Yeah. But the ones that they're domesticated are slightly smaller. And the way T'Pol said it, she just said, oh, they're slightly smaller. Like, I don't know, maybe 2 miles wide versus 1.9999 miles
yes,
wide.
Something like that,
slightly
yeah.
smaller. But I think it was Archer that then made a comment that Vulcan children never forget to feed.
No, so that's
sellouts.
That's when she compares the sellouts to Porthos, and he said that Porthos doesn't try to eat him if he's late for dinner. And then yeah. T'Pol's response that the Vulcan children are never late to feed their Sellout.
Yes, yes. But at this point, there is a concern that the one they've actually got bothering them at the moment could trap them there for several days.
Yeah.
Which is, that could be a concern.
Yes, it could.
On an alien planet.
On a desert.
Well, actually, I shouldn't say alien planet. That's potentially racist, isn't it? Because it's not alien to T'Pol.
Yeah, but it's how do you call that? Unfriendly environment?
Unfriendly territory, yes. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Back on Enterprise, Phlox is examining the bomb to find other DNA traces. And he discovers that the telomeres... Now, apparently the telomeres... I don't know whether this is actually factual to human DNA as well, but apparently they're strands within the code of the DNA that shorten as life goes on. And he identifies that the telomeres in T'Pol's DNA are too long to belong to a 32-year-old Vulcan. And I think he actually says they're around about the right length for, you know, a 3-month-old baby,
yes,
or something.
That's what he said, yes.
And it's been he concludes that somebody has falsified this evidence, and that it must have been taken from her infant DNA in the Vulcan database. We learned earlier on that Vulcan DNA is put into a database from birth.
Yeah. I guess they never heard about GDPR on Vulcan.
No. I would imagine that... despite their best efforts, I would imagine the European Union haven't quite managed to extend the reach of their laws to Vulcan. Well, you know, give it time.
Yeah.
From a recording that Malcolm recovered from the embassy, they're able to pinpoint the moment at which T'Pol's DNA signature was recorded. Now, they're not able to identify the suspect, but the guard who checked T'Pol, in air quotes again, into the embassy, seems to recognise the person that was checked in. Now, coincidentally, that same guard, Corporal Asquith was his name, is actually laying down beside them on a bed in sickbay in a coma.
That's a great coincidence.
Yes. Yeah. The note I wrote down here was dun dun dun.
Exactly. Well,
yeah.
It kind of makes sense. I mean, he's a human, so he was probably transferred to the Enterprise for medical care, and so yeah, okay. I'll give them that.
It's just occurred to me, the bomb explosion came from the direction of where the guard station was. So how did Forrest end up dying and Asquith ended up in a coma?
That's a very good question.
Huh.
Yeah.
Having said that, Asquith was behind quite a high desk.
Yeah.
And there was a smaller explosion before the big one, so he might have just got scared and ducked. I don't know. I'm clutching at straws.
Yeah. Yeah.
Back on Vulcan, the sellout that is... it sounds like sellout. The sellout that is currently bugging Archer and T'Pol is being driven away by a person named Arev, who claims to be on a pilgrimage, the same pilgrimage that the Cyrenites would take through the Forge. Archer pretends that he's also on a pilgrimage and asks if the three of them can walk together. Arev agrees, but not without saying that the Forge will be hard on the human.
Yeah, I think he even says that it will kill Archer.
Yeah, he said, you're welcome to join me, but it will probably kill you.
Yeah, something.
Yeah, nice. Thanks for that information.
Okay, I'll go with you anyway.
Keep that kind of stuff to yourself. Now, there was a very amusing exchange between T'Pol and Archer here about their respective racial tolerances, shall we say. T'Pol said that Archer wouldn't be able to handle the heat reflected from the ground. Archer said, I'll just walk on the sandy bits. Archer offers T'Pol some water. She says she won't need water for several days. He then offers her his sunglasses to protect her eyes, obviously forgetting that he still needs to protect his own.
But he had a cap, so yeah, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But the reflection from the ground.
Yeah, okay.
He'd be walking on the sandy bits, so it wouldn't matter. But then she said that her inner eyelids will protect her. I didn't know Vulcans had inner eyelids.
No.
Every day is a school day.
It sounds like a lizard from Voyager, but we're not talking about that.
No, but it just occurs to me that there's still so much that the humans don't know about Vulcans, and yet the Vulcans have got us pretty spot on.
Yeah.
That's what they've been doing for the last 1,500 years while we've been...
Maybe we're less complex creatures than the Vulcans.
Now, that's a very interesting... That's a debate topic.
We'll keep this philosophical question for when Jason comes back.
I think Jason would be really good to have that conversation with.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Jason, if you're listening.
As they are walking through the desert, Arev asks some questions of the captain and comes to the conclusion that Archer and T'Pol are not really on a pilgrimage.
Duh, really?
Duh. and then their discussion is rudely interrupted by a sand firestorm.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know whether you spotted this, but the two questions that Arev asked Archer were two of the questions that Spock answered in his memory test after he had his Catra reinserted or retransferred in the Search for Spock.
No, I didn't notice that.
Now, have you seen that film? I've seen all the movies,
but it was a long time ago.
Right. Now, I don't know whether you're looking at my show note guide.
I am, but I'm trying not to look at your personal notes.
All right, okay. Well, we'll give this a go. So, the two questions that Arev asked Archer. Now, bearing in mind, I couldn't have answered these. I had to go and look them up because of the similarity. I knew the questions existed in the Search for Spock, so I had to go and look up the answers. So, the first question was, who said, logic is the cement of our civilization with which we ascend from chaos using reason as our guide?
No, I don't have the answers.
No, I wouldn't have got that either. Apparently, it was the matron of Vulcan philosophy, T'Plana Hath. Got that. The second question was, what is Kiri Kintar's first law of metaphysics?
And it has nothing to do with Newton's first law of gravity.
It has nothing to do with Newton's first law. Nicely done. No, the answer to that was nothing unreal exists. Now, I remember that answer from the search for Spock, but I couldn't have answered it there. But yeah, I've mentioned this before. I just love the parallels between what we've seen so far in just this one season, in seven episodes, and the other parts of the Star Trek universe. I appreciate that kind of crossover.
They've done a great job. Now,
yeah, definitely.
About this Sunfire storm, did you notice that the storm is not too far away and coming towards them at a great speed, and yet they managed to escape just by running at regular speed?
This is the warp speed argument again, isn't it, really? Or the 200 kilometers an hour.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
In New York. Yeah. It's a totally, totally valid observation. I've got a similar one a bit further down, actually, with the when they seek refuge from the storm. But, yeah.
As a general observation, in this episode, there was less strange things like that than in previous episodes. I thought it was actually quite well filmed, and except for this sandstorm and the stone in the teaser where it really looked like it was cardboard. It was really well done.
So you were happy with the quality of the visual effects on the storm? This, yeah. Okay. Cool. Okay, so we're now on Act 3 of this episode, and we're aboard the Enterprise, and Tucker and Phlox are speaking to Saval, hoping that he can find someone capable of melding with Corporal Asquith. Given the taboo nature of the practice, Saval won't even consider their request. But as he turns to leave, Tucker reveals that the DNA evidence implicating T'Pau had been planted on the bomb. Assured by Phlox that this forgery could be proven, Saval, realizing that the tampering with the DNA record suggests a high-level conspiracy, offers to meld with the guard himself.
Yeah.
Quite a quick turnaround, I thought.
Yes, but he seemed very upset by the fact that the DNA was planted. So,
absolutely.
I guess it's the continuation of what he told Archer, that Archer would have his full support. And now he realizes that there's something maybe deeper than what he thought, and as a way to keep up to his word, something like that.
Yes, yeah, to keep to his word. Yeah.
So keep to his word, he's ready to do the meld.
I'm wondering at this point whether Saval thinks that there is something wrong in the High Council.
Yeah, I think so.
When he agrees to meld with Asquith, he kind of mutters under his breath the needs of the many.
Yeah.
Which, again, is something I think I mentioned it earlier. I don't think it was actually part of the episode. I think I mentioned it earlier. But, again, it's one of the Vulcan
mantra.
Ethoses. Ethi. I don't know. Plural of ethoses. In the forge, the three pilgrims, air quotes again, people. We should probably just break a little bit of the illusion here. Yannick and I are actually doing this over a video conference for the first time. We normally do it just over audio, so I can actually see Yannick and he can see me.
Hey.
So he can see me doing the air quotes, but no one else can. They find a shelter from the Sandfire storm in a cave. After seeing T'Pol's IDIC, he realizes who she is. Arav says that he has respect for the captain's actions, particularly regarding the Pajem Sanctuary, and agrees to bring them to the T'Kareth Sanctuary when the storm is over. Well, that is the location where T'Pol's mother is hiding there with the other Serenites.
Yeah.
Now, going back to the Sandfire storm, just for a moment, Arav said we need to get inside this cave because the... Oh, no, when they're inside the cave, he said, help me block the entrance up because the sandfire can still enter the cave. So they picked up these stuffing great rocks and piled them up against the door. But that would have had no impact whatsoever because you could fit a small child through those gaps. It's not as if they'd like sealed it up with cement or something and prevented it from coming in. He was that concerned about the sandstorm entering the cave, then I would have thought they would have done a better job than just rolling some boulders up to the door.
I noticed that too, that it was not really effective as a way to stop a sandstorm, because I mean sandstorm is like water, it's going to go as soon as there's a little hole, it would go through. And
it's interesting you mention it as water, because it's like a tap, isn't it? If you block up something, then the flow of water through it is going to be slower.
Yeah.
So I suppose in that respect, it may have had an impact.
Well, it's not necessarily going to be slower. I mean, if you reduce the surface of the tap, then water is going to flow twice as fast in half the surface. So the
oh
yeah.
I'm not convinced about that. We're kind of going into the realms of mechanics here, but if you turn a tap, it reduces the flow of water. It doesn't
make the water
come out thinner at the same volume.
I guess it depends
volume.
On it depends on the pressure, I guess. If there's a high pressure, then it will go faster. But anyway, we're not doing
that sandfire storm was high pressure,
yeah,
no question.
So. We're not doing a plumbing podcast. But Mark Johnson, he did some plumbing talk at Occam.
Absolutely, yes.
So Mark, if you're listening,
yeah,
you're invited.
And we'll let him know if any doors come up as well. Sort those out too. Right, so actually this next bit is a missing scene. From the review that we took from Memory Alpha, because it didn't cover the mind meld. So Saval is currently mind melding with Asquith back in sickbay on the Enterprise. And he is following through the events of what happened in the Earth Embassy on Vulcan through Asquith's eyes. And he sees who we... kind of believe is T'Pau, who the Vulcan High Command believe is T'Pau, scanning through embassy security. And Saval sees a figure go through holding a package, probably about the size of a shoebox, maybe slightly smaller. And then both he and we briefly see a face, although to us it's obscured.
Yeah.
But from the way that he suddenly recoils from Asquith in shock, it's very, very clear to us that he has recognised who that person is.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Now, I'm a bit knocked at this point because tell us who it is, I want to know who it is, but they cut it just at the point where we would have actually recognised him, they cut it.
Yeah, there's something, once again, I'm picking on this episode, but out of everybody in the room at this moment, that character that we don't know who he is yet is the only one with a green cape with a hood on his head. I mean, if I'm looking at the security camera and I see someone like that, I say, this guy is it looks weird, sir. But no. Okay, go ahead.
The most suspicious looking character. Absolutely. In the entire foyer of that embassy, and they're just waved through.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, odd one. So back in the cave, Archer tells Arif the real reason why they are there. Archer explains that the Vulcan High Command claim that the Cyrenites believe in a corrupted version of Cyrax teaching. To that, Arif answers that some people say that Cyrax Katra was found and is now carried by a Cyrenite. In case you're not entirely sure about this, the Catra of a Vulcan is effectively the essence of their soul. It's the knowledge of everything that they've experienced as a Vulcan during their lifetime. If you have seen the Search for Spock, the Spock's Catra was a very keen part of that, of the storyline of that film. So according to the rumor here, all who mind meld with this Serenite that they're referring to can touch Surak's mind, because his mind is effectively contained within the mind of this Serenite that's carrying his Catra.
Yeah.
Looking at T'Pol, Arev says that Surak said that the mind meld was the heritage of all Vulcans, whether they believe in it or not.
Yeah.
Now, I... right, so this was a season 2 episode, I think, when T'Pol is visited on the Enterprise by some fellow Vulcans, and they're trying to get her to embrace her emotions. Yes. I can't remember what the episode was.
I remember that.
And they went into it's around about the time that she lost her ability to meditate, and she started getting the urges that her meditation was supposed to calm down. And I think that was probably the first time that she experienced mind melding in person. So from this, it's not entirely clear from our perspective, but I think that, T'Pol is very much against this idea of Vulcans being able to tap into other Vulcans' minds.
It sends us back to when she explained that the Serenite was a corrupted way to follow Sarek's teachings, and I think that's the mind meld is associated with those Serenites and those corrupted ways. Maybe I'm making that up, but I was under the impression that it was like that.
I don't necessarily recall that particular part. However, it does make sense.
Yeah, okay. So maybe I've read that somewhere on Memory Alpha, or I don't know. I don't remember.
Yeah, possibly. Back on Enterprise, Saval, Phlox, and Trip meet up with Vlas and Stell. When they ask who the real culprit is, Saval reveals the truth, that actually it is Stell. They claim to have an eyewitness who identified him as the one who planted the bomb in the embassy. When Stell and Vlas asked to speak with the witness, like that was going to happen, Phlox says that his patient is in a coma. And then I think that Vlas started to question how this person, this eyewitness, was in a coma, yes, and yet managed to give an account. And then Saval admits to have performed a mind meld on Asquith. Stell protests, noting that the telepathic evidence, anything retrieved from a mind meld, is actually inadmissible in law. Vlas informs the ambassador that he will be summoned to appear before the High Command to account for his actions. Now, the only observation I got out of this is that clearly the acceptability of the mind meld changed over time. And I'm wondering if this is the point where it happened, because in the original series, Spock performed a mind meld multiple times. Sarek performed it on Kirk, mm-hmm, in The Search for Spock. Spock performed it on Valaris in The Undiscovered Country. So, I mean, Sarek was the Vulcan ambassador to Earth at that time. Yep. If the mind meld was a forbidden action, there's no way he would have done that, even in the privacy of Kirk's quarters.
Yeah, I think it changed after maybe not just after this episode, but yeah, between Enterprise and the original series. Because yeah, in the original series and any series after that, there was the Vulcan didn't seem to have any kind of problem performing mind meld.
Maybe it was new. It was it wasn't understood.
Maybe
what the mind meld was and what the impact could be on the two parties involved. Because mm-hmm. I think it was, I can't remember who said it now, that the person that performs the mind meld is as vulnerable to, let's say, attack from the person being melded to.
Yeah, it's a two-way.
As the other way around.
Yeah, it's a two-way connection.
Yeah.
So, yep.
So, we are now in the final act of the episode. We're back in the forge. The storm is gaining in strength. And as they are trying to reseal the cavern entrance, T'Pol is hit by an electric discharge from the storm. Another discharge hits Arev, but this time it's deadly. And just before he dies, Arev mind melds with the captain, saying that he must carry it to the sanctuary.
Yes.
Mm.
That's when I understood what was going on.
Yes, but seemingly Archer didn't understand what was going on. Well, in fact, he'd been nerve pinched at that point, so he was
incapacitated,
stunned, or whatever. Incapacitated. Good word as any. Back on the Enterprise, Saval is going to turn himself in to the Vulcan High Command. When Tucker protests and accuses the ambassador of not trusting humans, Saval responds, "Peace and long life."
Yeah.
Suggesting that he has a lot more respect for Tucker than Tucker realizes.
Yeah. But why not live long and prosper?
Right. I looked this up. Live long and prosper is actually a response to peace and long life.
Oh, okay.
It's part of it's a ceremonial. I think this is actually when you're departing from somebody.
Okay.
You would say, so one person would say peace and long life, and then the other person would respond with live long and prosper.
And Dev is doing the Vulcan.
I'm doing the Vulcan salute. I don't know. Maybe one day we'll release these videos, but
maybe,
not yet.
No, we're not ready. The world is not ready.
Back in the cave, Archer is awakened by T'Pol. He said that Arev said something to him, which turns out to be the Vulcan word for remember. But neither Archer nor T'Pol understand what it means. So the phrase that Arev used, the full phrase, was Tulek Tu Vokal, or Voku, I'm not sure actually. Tulek Tu means you are the vessel, and Vokal means remember.
Isn't that what Spock said?
Yes, that is exactly what Spock said in The Wrath of Khan when he melded with McCoy. He didn't say it in Vulcan. He said it in English. He said, "I'm sorry, Doctor, I don't have time to explain this logically." As he's nerve pinched him, and then he puts his hand on his face and just says, "Remember." Yes. But we don't see that in The Wrath of Khan. We see that in the playback of the security footage in The Search for Spock at the beginning of the film,
which, as any security footage on any series, is actually the camera from the movie, and not a security camera.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned this, because this is a little bit of a tangent, but it's something that does bug me. If you're looking at security camera footage, the likelihood is the security camera is going to be in a fixed position, or if it does move, it moves in two fixed planes.
Yeah.
What it can't do necessarily is follow someone's face. Because the security footage that we saw at the beginning of The Search for Spock, when it was after Sarek had done the mind meld with Kirk, and they were looking at the security footage of the reactor just before Spock goes into the reactor. And Spock said, what was the phrase? He said, enhance and augment. So that was basically telling the computer to zoom into the to the footage. And the camera zooms in right on Spock's face and McCoy's face, and kind of moves around a bit as if somebody was like holding a camera there. But you wouldn't have that with a security camera.
So yeah, I agree with you, Dave.
Excellent. Archer and T'Pol agree to continue searching for the sanctuary, which is supposed to be nearby, after burying Arev. Archer has some strange intuitions and finds the sanctuary easily. As they enter through a disguised portal, Archer tells T'Pol not to resist. Inside, they are seized by a group of armed Vulcans. To be continued.
Yay. At some point, Archer said that he didn't need the water, and T'Pol respond, "You're not Vulcan," and he say, "Oh yeah."
So, also Archer told T'Pol not to resist. So when they are seized, the first thing she did was resist.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
of course.
Now. I know we keep referring back to, I know I keep referring back to this, but thinking about the intuition that that Archer's picked up, I do seem to remember in the Journey Home, the Search for Spock. No, it was the Journey Home. I do seem to remember that McCoy was picking up a lot of bits of Spock's personality. Sorry, it was the Search for Spock. Picking up bits of Spock's personality. And knowledge.
Yeah.
So things like when he went into the bar and he orders a drink that I can't remember what the drink was, but he orders a drink that it's the kind of thing that
Vulcan.
That Spock would have ordered. And then the waitress says, "Well, that's not your normal poison." And then McCoy says, "To order poison in a bar is not logical."
Yeah.
Yes, anyway.
Yeah, I seem to remember a scene with McCoy, in his quarter, and he's talking to himself almost, and when Kirk enters the room, and then he realizes there's something wrong, and that's some part of Spock's personality.
In that scene, Kirk thought it was Spock.
Yes.
Right at the very beginning of it.
Yeah.
I tell you what, this is going to be the last thing I mention about the Search for Spock, but it's such a good film. It's a bit of a visual gag, but I will explain it for listeners. When they are about to break McCoy out of the place where he's being held in order for them to go and go and find Spock, Kirk walks into the room. They've disabled the guards. And he says, "How many fingers am I holding up?" Whilst doing the Vulcan salute in his face. And McCoy says, "That's not very damn funny." Yes. Anyway, enough Search for Spock. We are supposed to be reviewing The Forge, which that was the end of the review. So yeah. Unless there's anything else.
No, I liked this episode very much. It was very intense in terms of the story, and they built that very nicely. I was a bit surprised by the fact that Teles is a Serenite, but everything holds together. I mean, there's nothing that. Well, there's a few things here and there that are probably tied to special effects and things like that. But story-wise, it was a very, very good story. And I really liked, as you said earlier, the parallels between this episode and the original series and the movies. So if anybody's a fan of the movies, I guess, but by this point, we know what happened to Archer, and we kind of see what's coming, but I'm eager to see next episode, which we're going to review next week.
Indeed we are.
So now that the review is over, we have a few things to talk about. We're going to go over some news items later on. But we had a discussion with Dave this week. We thought that we are both listening to a podcast that's called The School of Podcasting by Dave Jackson. And he does something that he calls, because of my podcast, I and fill the blanks. And, you know, he asks his audience to tell him stories. And we thought that it could be interesting if you listeners were to send us your stories of because of Star Trek. So maybe because of Star Trek you met someone, or because of Star Trek you got a job, as we know that Ryan didn't exactly get his job, yeah, but he's using what he learned in Star Trek for his job. So if you have a story, a because of Star Trek story, please send that to us, feedback at trgreyhot.org. And we will be happy to read that. And if you send it to us, and if you don't tell us to not read it, we're going to read that on one of the episodes. So send us an email at feedback@trgreyhot.org, and maybe add because of Star Trek in the subject line. And it could be a few lines. It could be half a book if you want. We don't mind. We'll have feedback. So. We thought it was maybe something you could enjoy.
Yeah, definitely. I'll have to send mine in, because at the moment I can't think of anything specific that because of Star Trek. Well, apart from because of Star Trek, I'm now doing a review podcast with my friend.
That's what I was going to say.
I can't think of anything else at the moment, but I'm sure I might be able to think of something given a small amount of time.
Yeah. Right, so time to go over a few news items. So the first news item is not really good news. It's a sad news. Aaron Eisenberg, who played Nog in Star Trek Deep Space Nine, passed away on September 21st at the age of 50. So our thoughts and prayers are with his family. And he played about, I think, 40 or 50 episodes of Deep Space Nine. And I really liked the character. He was playing a Ferengi that was, friend with Jake Sisko, and they started as young boys, and then we saw the evolution of those characters. And that's life, but it's still very sad news.
It is. I mean, as I mentioned before, I don't think I've seen any full episodes of Deep Space Nine. But 50 is no age. Yeah. It's really sad when anybody, I was going to say when anybody dies before their time. It's sad when anybody dies at all. But it's certainly in the context of Star Trek, any of the actors that have played characters within Star Trek. Yeah, it's sad to hear. Yeah.
So on other news, we know now that Star Trek Picard is not a sequel to Star Trek The Next Generation, as Patrick Stewart said. About 20 years have passed since Next Gen, and Picard is not in contact with many of his former crewmates. That's what Picard said in Patrick Stewart said in an interview. He also said, "Don't expect the whole crew to the Enterprise to be back together. Only some character will come back, but won't probably have a big part in the story." So it really. And I also read somewhere that Patrick Stewart said that Picard will surprise people. So I at the beginning I thought, because it was Picard, it might have something to do with the continuation of Next Gen, but it appears that it's not going to be the case at all. I know that Picard will not wear a uniform for this series. He will, because there's a flashback that was, again, that's in the interview from Patrick Stewart. But otherwise, he won't have a uniform. So is he still with Starfleet, or is... Lots of questions, and I guess we're going to have to wait for Star Trek Picard to be on the screens to find out about that. But lots of questions and so little answers.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, personally, I didn't even consider that Picard would have been a sequel to The Next Generation. So
yeah, maybe not a sequel, but you know, it was,
or even a follow on from.
Yeah. Well, we'll see that.
Hmm.
Will Data be Data on Star Trek Picard? In an interview at Comic-Con 2019, Brent Spiner said that Data will be in the show, but not on every episode, and that, I quote, "What you think happens is not what happens." So Brent Spiner did not say anything else, so we will have to wait for that too, for the series to come on screen, to actually understand what he means, because he was very cryptic after that when he was asked question about is it Data, is it before, is it is Data dismantled in the trailer that we've seen, and he always deflected the question and said, well, I can't tell you anything, you're gonna have to wait. So I guess that's what we're gonna have to do.
Indeed.
We did actually wonder if it was Data or not, and it seems that he's credited as Data, so that's settled. It's not before, it's not Lore, it's not anyone else.
Was there a Mirror Universe Data?
I don't know.
TNG had a Mirror Universe.
Yes, they had. But I don't remember if there was a Data in there.
I don't know.
Today, the day of recording on October 2nd, it is Avery Brooks' birthday, who played Captain Sisko on DS9. As we said already, he's one of my favorite captain with Picard. So happy birthday, Avery Brooks. If you're listening to this show and you want to come join us, please, please, you will be very welcome.
Every opportunity.
Absolutely. Talking about anniversaries, a few days ago on September 27th was the 18th anniversary of Star Trek Enterprise. So we are reviewing, we are in season 4, so we are reviewing is it 14 or 15 year old episode?
Yeah, it would be, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like it was, I don't know, maybe 5-10 years ago, but no, it's 15 years ago, this episode.
It's worth remembering that the gap between Enterprise and Discovery, which were consecutive series, was, you know, best part of 14 odd years.
Mm.
Not quite as long as the gap between the original series and Next Gen.
No, because there was
Next Gen was 87?
But yeah.
So yeah, just short of 20 years then, 18 years.
Mm-hmm. And also to round up this news section, 25 years ago on the September 19th, 1994, Kate Mulgrew filmed her first scenes of Star Trek Voyager. So, yeah, 25 years since the beginning of filming of Voyager. And the series was aired, I think, in the next January. So in January 2020, it's going to be the 25th anniversary of the first airing of the Voyager. So I know we often pick on Voyager as being, not the best Star Trek series, but it has its moments. It has its moments, you know.
And another one that we haven't noted down here is that it was 32 years ago on the 28th of September 1987 that the first episode of Next Generation was broadcast.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know whether this is pure coincidence or whether it's because that's how they do series releases in the United States. That's
how they did, I think, because back then it was always, well, it was often started the series in September, and they didn't have, as far as I can tell, they didn't have mid-season start, and now they are. Now they do sometimes they do half a season for a new series, sometimes first season is only 12 episodes and it starts at mid-season.
Yeah.
It's kind of a way to, you know, to grab the attention, if I can say that, to new viewers, because sometimes you watch a series and then you get bored or you don't like it. And if they commit for a full year, then they have to, you know, live with that. But yeah, every Star Trek series so far has started on around September, end of September. So happy birthday to every Star Trek series.
Yes. Every Star Trek series ever.
Ever. And that concludes our news roundup. Well, now all that's left to do is to thank everyone who downloaded our episodes. We say that every week, but it really means a lot to us.
It does, most definitely.
We see the numbers grow slowly but steadily. So thank you. Thanks for sharing the episodes, talking to your friends or family, and helping us spread the word on social media. Well, you can find our podcast pretty much everywhere now, I guess. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Teacher, whatever. I'm probably missing a lot of them. If you don't see us where you expect to see us, then send us an email and we'll try to fix that.
So this episode uses material from the article The Forge on Memory Alpha over at Fandom, and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License. And as always, we extend our thanks to Memory Alpha for doing a lot of the work for us, to be fair.
Yeah, thank you guys. So a little bit of housekeeping before we leave. Our website can be found at teargrayhut.org, and you can go there to read our show notes, and you can leave us feedback on this episode's page. You can also leave feedback on the contact form. That's teargrayhut.org/contact. In case your comments are not directly related to this episode, for example, if you want to tell us your Because of Star Trek story.
Absolutely. And of course, you can also send us feedback via email. Our address is feedback@teargrayhut.org.
You can also join us on various social media like Twitter, Facebook, or Telegram. We are at TEDH Podcast everywhere. So that's twitter.com/TEDHpodcast, facebook.com/TEDHpodcast, Telegram. Telegram is different. That's t.me/TEDHpodcast.
And we're also on Mastodon social network. We're on the mastodon.social instance, I suppose you call it. So that's mastodon.social/TEGHpodcast.
Unless otherwise stated, this episode is released under a Creative Commons by Attribution Share Alike license, which means that you can do pretty much whatever you want with it, as long as you credit us as the original authors. And if you publish something based on this episode, you have to release it under the same license.
This podcast is part of the Other Side Podcast Network. We do have an increasing slate of podcasts over on the network. You can find out more information about all the shows over at otherside.network.
And if I don't forget, you will hear a bumper for the Other Side Podcast Network at the end of this episode, but that's not guaranteed.
Yeah, well, it's not guaranteed if I do it, because the last two shows I've edited, I've completely forgotten to do it.
Yeah, I'm picking on you.
Yes. Well, to be fair, I've got enough dirt on you that I can always retaliate.
Yeah.
Next week, we will be reviewing Enterprise Season 4, Episode 8, Awakening. And we will be joined by another mystery special guest. Now, still waiting for final confirmation on this, but this is actually the first guest who has approached us and asked to be on the show. So I'm over the moon.
Yes, I'm not gonna say yes, of course.
We said, yeah, absolutely. In fact, that was it. He said, can I be on TEGH? I just replied, yes.
Yeah.
So, next week we will have a guest. It is somebody who is has been podcasting for a very long period of time. I do believe he is very much a very big Star Trek fan. So it'll be really good to have him on the show next week.
Yes, and as I said to you earlier, it's been ages since I spoke with him. So I'm really looking forward to having him on the show. Well, that's it for this episode of Tea Earl Grey Hut. I guess all that's left to do is to say goodbye, and we will catch you next week. In the meantime, take care of yourselves. Ciao, ciao.
See ya.
You've been listening to a member of the Other Side Podcast Network. Find out more about our shows at otherside.network.